I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude is what we do. This one is about why we love radio and about the man, Tony Schwartz, who showed us the ropes and introduced us to the power of sound, the joy of audio. The big man in the we here is David Hoffman, decorated and prolific documentary filmmaker, who studied Tony, knew him well, interviewed him in depth, and made movies about him. David Hoffman, short course, how did you get to know him? When did you realize you were in the presence of a most extraordinary guy?
I'd made my first television documentary-style commercial, 1964. I won an award in New York, and I was at the awards banquet. I was 24 years old, and there was a man sitting across from me, and he had won for his commercial Plop, Plop, Fizz, Fizz, Oh, What a Relief It Is, which I didn't think was all that much, but apparently they did in New York because the sound was so rich with bubbles and the glass. You could hear the glass. It was incredible to the New York advertising world. And he asked me a critical question, one of the most critical questions of my life, actually, at the table. He said, "You make documentaries. Are they true?" And I, in a great moment, thought about it and said, "No. Nothing is the truth. I make my own point of view and try to convince you of that point of view, but I couldn't say that I tell the truth. I don't even know what that is." And he looked at me and he said, "I'd like you to come over to my studio. Maybe we could work together." I went over to his studio the next day, and I walked into a world that you've been in also, Chris, I believe, which was just unbelievable, the Tony Schwartz studio on West 58th Street in New York.
Near the CBS studios, but more famous as the old Hell's Kitchen on the west side of New York. And Tony's apartment was so unusual. It had a church-like space about it. In fact, I think it might have been a little church at some point. But he sat there at his desk with his turntables. I'm thinking there was an element of The Wizard of Oz about him. There was an element of Orson Welles. There was an element of Marshall McLuhan. I mean, a man with deep ideas, a man with lots of tricks, and a man with a certain magical authority. But let's stick with 1964. That was a historic year. That was the year in which Tony made his most famous, most notorious commercial for, I think, Doyle Dan Birnbach, who had the Lyndon Johnson account in that campaign against Barry Goldwater. And he did this spot, the most famous spot that only ran once.
That's right.
With the girl picking petals off a daisy. Here it is.
One, two, three, four, five, seven, six, eight, nine.
The stakes to make a world in which all of God's children can live or to go into the dark. We must either love each other or we must die.
First response, David?
Well, that spot not only defined America, it changed America. By the way, it did only run once, and the reaction was so strong they had to take it off the air. But it also defined Tony Schwartz to himself, because he made that spot as he made all his 27,000 radio commercials, and I don't know how many television commercials, with a certain attitude. The attitude was either I agree with it or I don't do it. He was no advertising man, and he was no mouthpiece for anybody. He was concerned about nuclear war because at the time, America and the Soviet Union were building thousands of nuclear weapons. It was a huge rise in nuclear weapons. He wanted to make this because he thought it was the right thing to do. He wasn't even talking about Barry Goldwater, the opponent. He was talking about Lyndon Johnson and that particular statement that he made that Tony agreed with. Also, Tony was using a still photograph of a girl picking daisies that moved every once in a while. Tony never cared about the visual. He always cared about the sound. And so the result of this spot was that it got yanked off the air. Barry Goldwater was furious. It became national. And Tony figured out something, learned something that was going to define him for the rest of his life.
You know, the funny thing is that I'd forgotten was that he had played with that countdown and the girl with the daisy pedal for years before 1964. But let's listen also to his commentary after the Goldwater commercial ran. It's just as interesting as the spot.
This spot is interesting because it caused a sensation. People said it was the dirtiest spot ever done. People said that it was asking whose finger do you want on the trigger. It never mentioned Goldwater's name. I think it's just like a Rorschach pattern. You take a Rorschach pattern and show it to a person, or a psychologist or doctor will, and the person will say, "Doctor, I didn't come here to be shown dirty pictures." Now, it's just an ink blot, but they see things in it. They read things from their past experience. Now, people were doing that with this spot. Goldwater had spoken for dropping a nuclear weapon in the men's room at the Kremlin. He had spoken for use of nuclear weapons to defoliate the jungles of East Asia, to take the leaves off the trees. And I've spoken to experts, you can't take the leaves off the trees without hurting the people below them. And he had spoken for the European commanders, NATO commanders, to have sole discretion on the use of nuclear weapons. They wouldn't have to check with the president or anyone else. So people thought of him as trigger happy in that context. I think if Barry Goldwater wanted to take away the negative effect of that commercial, he could have offered to pay for half of its running and say that this commercial should be the theme of the election this year. How do we keep nuclear peace in this world? And I think if he had done that, he would have taken the thorns out of it. The commercial in itself didn't mention him. He said, "I'm guilty," by complaining about it. And they probably spent about $3,500 on the production of the whole spot. It's amazing.
It is amazing. So much Tony doctrine is buried in that little conversation, David. Do you want to pick out the themes?
I think Tony was the first person to show me why Ronald Reagan was so powerful. Mm. He took out that press conference where Ronald Reagan, in answer to a question, said, "I don't know." Tony thought that was a defining moment in American politics. He thought that was the first time a president ever said, "I don't know." And sure enough, within days, Ronald Reagan's ratings went skyrocketing. Tony was right. What he concluded was, when you make yourself human, you really have humanity as part of what you say, your foibles, your personal feelings. You increase your credibility with the audience you're trying to reach, and Tony was all about credibility. For example, Tony used to say, when Smith Barney said, "When people talk, we listen," which was their advertising campaign, Tony said, "Is there any American who actually believes that when people talk, Smith Barney listens?" He couldn't think of one, and I couldn't think of one. So Tony was about being somewhat, as much as you could be, honest on the radio.
That's fascinating. I got to know him in 1972 a little bit when I was covering George McGovern, but then went back forever to sit at Tony's knee and listen to what was going on. But in 1974, I wrote a piece about him in the New York Times in which that was the whole point of an ad he was doing for Senator Abe Ribicoff in Connecticut. The theme of that season in the Ford presidency was inflation. Remember, whip inflation now, the wind buttons and all that sort of stuff. And the ad simply showed still pictures, not especially interesting, of Abe Ribicoff in the grocery store with his wife, marveling at the prices. He said, "I see people putting things back that they really need to eat, but the prices are so high." And he had no solution, no plan, no program. But Tony felt to show Abe Ribicoff out there in Hartford in the grocery store, you know, suffering what people suffer and reacting, was the main point. There are two ads involving Jimmy Carter that I think illustrate this point and how Tony could turn a campaign around
Well, the first thing really, Chris, is why did Jimmy Carter go to Tony Schwartz? That's really interesting. Now, you know, Tony was one man in one studio in New York City, yet everybody but the Pope came to Tony Schwartz's little studio. Jimmy Carter came because Jimmy Carter wasn't doing very well. He couldn't communicate anything other than Peanut Farmer, and he had a strident kind of a voice. Mm-hmm. He really wasn't winning, and Tony agreed to take on Jimmy Carter. I was there for that. And
really?
What happened was, yes, Tony said to Jimmy, "Jimmy, you're going to have to come into my studio, and you're going to have to sit here for days." He put Jimmy Carter on the couch, almost like a therapist. He made Jimmy Carter lie down on that couch and just sit there, lie there, and slowly ramble. He slowed him down. He made Jimmy talk about the personal things in Jimmy's life, and then he used them. And that was the way Jimmy Carter became human to us, the American people. And if had it not been for that, I don't believe Jimmy Carter stood a chance in hell of winning.
It was very much like therapy, David, I think.
Very much. And that was Tony. You entered this quiet space with 13 television sets, which when he wasn't recording, were running. And when he was recording, he turned off the sound, but not the picture. He felt the picture didn't interfere with anything. So here were these 13 television sets, mics all over the place, couches, pictures of Gandhi and the Kennedys when they came into his place, and the Johnson boys, Johnson and his people when they came in, and all kinds of other famous people. And you just sat there, and Tony looked at you through his thick glasses, and he said, "So, how do you feel about food? I mean, does anyone in your family have a problem with shopping?" And then he would look down and push the button on his tape recorder, which was an analog recorder with a loud click. Boom, it went. And you then started to ramble at a man that, besides everything else, you felt that you could say anything to Tony, and that he would not judge you harshly. He would disagree, but he never gave you the feeling that he was better than you, smarter than you. He just was Tony Schwartz, a guy with a tape recorder in New York City who wanted to know what you had to say about something.
David Huffman, let's listen to the Jimmy Carter before and after commercials. I think it's a complete lesson in the Schwartz method.
I got called into the Carter campaign the last 2 months of the campaign. That was the Carter-Ford campaign. And I wanted to see what they had done before. And here's what they were doing before I got involved.
There's only one person in this country who can answer difficult questions or carve out bold proposals for giving our people services that they need. There's only one person in this country that can root out discrimination and hatred and divisions in our nation. There's only one person that can speak for our country with a bold and compassionate and an honest voice to the foreign community. And that person is the president.
He was always speaking to other people, to a crowd or to a group of people in his backyard or to the person who was interviewing him. The size of the head was about 1/12 of the screen or less. And I felt if you just enlarge that, there would be tremendous more emotionality in it. Another thing, I don't like to use music in a commercial with someone talking directly to you, because if you're coming to talk to me and I hear music, I feel, look, if you want to talk to me, what do you bring your musicians for? And here's an example of the type of spot I did with Carter, just talking to you.
I'm Jimmy Carter. Gerald Ford voted against Medicare, against food stamps for the elderly, against adequate housing. Isn't it bad enough that older people are the worst victims, the easiest victims of hoodlums and criminals? Must they also be victimized by their own government in Washington? How could anyone serve in the White House without wanting to help them?
There's the difference.
I think... Yes, and I listen to it now, and it sounds a little old now. We're better at this now. Reality is more real than Jimmy was there, and advertising is more advertising than even that band that Jimmy Carter brought with him. By the way, if I find irritating to you, Chris, I can't stand the music in that.
No, absolutely. But it's the stridency. We got to talk about how we all get to talk like the second Jimmy Carter. Relax. You're not the smartest man.
There's more than that. Tony said, speak like you're speaking to one person.
Yes.
Never speak like you're giving a speech. He said, leave in some of your foibles, your ums and your ahs. Mm. He said, when you say something important, you might want to say it twice because I didn't quite get it. And above everything else, he said, never talk down to your audience. Mm. Always talk with your audience.
You know, I'd forgotten it till you mentioned it. He said to me, and I do a lot of interviewing, he said, the position of the interviewer should be like that scientist looking deep into a microscope at invisible microscopic bugs.
You know, he also had something else that just occurred to me that was quite wonderful, and I learned this from Tony and I've used it all my life, which is he wasn't afraid of anybody, and he would call anybody. And I actually saw him call the Pope. He wanted the Pope, a speech from the Pope in one of his radio spots, and he called the Pope right in the Vatican. I mean, and at one point I heard Tony say, somebody said, I'm sorry, he's not at his desk. And Tony said, well, I'm not at my desk either. And another time I heard him say, somebody at the other end of the line said, who's calling? And Tony said, tell him it's his mother. I mean, he got through to everybody. People became, in New York City, certainly as you know, the political structure was terrified when Tony made an ad because he would take his little radio ad and run it once on the radio in a cheap station and immediately would get to the person he was targeting and they would hear the thing and call him up and say, get that off the air. I'll do something about it right now.
That business about people will hear it if it involves them, it was core doctrine to Tony. I want to play something I think you got out of him, which was the famous line that people are born without ear lids, that there's a fundamental difference between the ear and the eye, how they work, what they teach us, and it's crucial to his thinking.
Absolutely. Tony said that everyone can blink and they can close their eyes and they can look the other way. But people have no ear lids. The ear operates merely on interests, what interests you. If something interests you, if I say, I got divorced and it really pained me. Well, if you just got divorced, you're going to hear my next sentence. That was Tony's view.
Hmm. Let's hear his version.
We have a fantastic advantage on our side with the use of radio in politics and even with television in a way. And that is, people are born without ear lids. They have eyelids, but they don't have ear lids. So what determines what people hear? In a very simple way, they hear what interests them. They hear what concerns them. If you hear an ad with your name in it, of course you'll hear it. If you're at a party and there's all the hubbub, but you hear your school name or your name or your candidate's name, you'll hear it. So if we pre-search people's concerns and also pre-search their media habits, what stations they listen to, what programs they watch, we can know that they will hear our commercial if it relates to something they're concerned with. Here's a piece of research we did. This woman's attitudes about the telephone company.
I hate the phone company. I'm helpless in their grasp. I really am. No matter what happens, I've got to go along with them or they could take my phone away from me and I don't want to lose my telephone. You know, no matter how many calls I have over calls, I have to say that they're right. I could argue with them, but in the long run, they've got the better of me. I can do nothing about it.
So I began to spot this way. And if her radio was on, she had to hear it.
Tell me something. Only tell me the truth. Have you ever felt like getting even with a phone company? Maybe suing them?
So you can bet that if her radio was on, even if she was talking to someone else, she'd have to hear that.
Reminds me of something Mark Shield's father used to say, which was that the most beautiful sound a man can hear is his own name shouted across a crowded room.
Well, you know, Tony did do that. He was hired by CBS Radio to reach Ford Motor Company, who wasn't buying CBS in Detroit. And so he produced an ad, a radio ad, that said, are you the president of a car company? And he not only got Ford, he got all three major car company CEOs heard it and bought CBS Radio. Tony mentions in the last comment, pre-search. There's an idea that he came up with. He said, most people who do communication research to find out the result of the effect of their communication. They basically find out something after the fact. Tony was interested in what someone felt before the fact, before the spot was made. So when he went after McDonald's for cooking French fries in tallow oil, he first found out that people cared about eating healthy and not getting high cholesterol. He knew what people cared about, so he connected people's feelings with what he wanted to say, and boy, McDonald's responded immediately and stopped using tallow oil.
Mm. For candidates whose names were not known, Tony was incredibly bold and inventive about making them known. There's a spot we love here called the Dean Robb spot. Do you remember this? Listen.
Supreme Court. Now, that's important. They oversee the court system for the whole state. Look at all those names. You can only elect two. How do they expect me to find Dean Robb? I got to vote for Dean Robb because he has the most trial experience. So let me see. Dean Robb. There he is. Dean Robb. I'm glad I found him.
Yes, that was a way that Tony spoke to the public. He first found out that there was a problem, that Dean Robb was not the first name on the list. And he concluded that people would have trouble, and he was going to help them find Dean Robb, and in the process, over the course of a bunch of radio spots, give people a sense of who Dean Robb was without hitting them over the head with a hammer. That was Tony. And using that spot, everyone who heard it and remembered it. I bet you Dean Robb still remembers that spot because he won handily.
You know, there are so many practical tricks here, but the difference with Tony, David, among a whole world of clever advertising people, was that he had some fundamental, theoretical, original breakthroughs in his thinking. And they moved me. They moved me, among other things, out of print into television and eventually to radio. I remember when I first took him my TV tapes, he said he was always a gentle guy, but he said, you don't understand what you're doing. Television is not a medium of information, as you're used to providing it in the New York Times. It's a medium of effects, emotional effects, personal effects. He also taught me then and later that the ear carries the heaviest freight of electronic media. The eye is so often a distraction. I learned that later. When I grew a mustache on vacation, people went nuts. I realized most of the time people looking at a man on television are looking at his hair. Is he losing it? Is he dying it? Has he got enough? Has he had a haircut? Does he need a haircut? If he's making any impression at all, it's in the words he's saying and how he's saying them, but you almost have to block off the image that you're looking at to get the message. People look at Barbara Walters and say she's changed hairdressers, or they look at Dan Rather right. and say he's into the right. shoe polish again, or whatever. In some of Tony's most effective commercials, we should play them, he basically canceled out the video. There's one that makes the point very clearly where in the George McGovern campaign in 1972, which was floundering at the end, Tony was called in to do some Hail Mary passes, but one of them just showed a man walking into a voting booth, pull the curtain, and then you're looking at the curtain for 55 seconds and hearing the man talk to himself. This is what you hear.
Well, either way, it won't be a disaster.
What am I looking for?
I mean, so I'll vote for Nixon. Why rock the boat? I'm not crazy about it.
Never was.
I gotta decide, though. I gotta make up my mind.
I'm not crazy about McGovern either.
I don't have that much time. I can't keep people waiting.
The fellas are voting Nixon.
They expect me to vote for him, too.
Me vote for Nixon.
My father'd roll over in his grave.
The fellas say they are.
I don't know. Maybe they're not.
Crime?
I don't feel safe.
Price is up.
Got a very feeling. Don't vote for Nixon.
Why am I confused?
Who am I measuring McGovern against?
My gut feeling. McGovern.
This hand voted for Kennedy.
I mean, it's just possible. McGovern's straight.
Maybe he can.
that's the way.
There's no visual image there, just a man, at least pretending, to be thinking through, looking for rationales that other people might have for saying, hell with it, I'm voting for McGovern.
That's really a Tony Schwartz philosophy. He's speaking what he believes, and he was right, is in the mind of his audience.
Now, yes.
His audience was not Republicans. In this case, he is pitching what Tony said, preaching to the converted. He felt sometimes you spoke to people who didn't agree with you, and there your goal in communication was to start from the position that they felt and move them to a position closer to how you felt. That's how to communicate. But when you're speaking to people who already agree with you, you just need to go into their, what he called, stored memory and communicate with it, and that was real communication. He also, this is important, I think, Chris, and by the way, I'm glad he got you into radio. It's very important to see how Tony saw television and how Tony saw radio. Tony felt television was about audio. He taught me that.
Yes.
It wasn't about visual. He said, running the opening of Out of Africa on television, that huge landscape of Africa, you don't even see the image, but hearing what the woman says at the start of Out of Africa, that's what it's about. And he would say, turn off the picture for an evening of TV, and you'll still get TV. Turn off the sound for an evening of TV, and you'll just look at the pictures, and you won't get anything. He also noticed that people very often got up from their seat in television, went to the bathroom, got a beer, talked to other people, but in the car, listening to the radio, or at home listening to the radio, and even on the internet listening to the radio, people really listen. There's not a lot of other things to do. Mm. You don't change stations. Do you know that Tony did study on this. The average woman changes the channel using the remote switch every 30 seconds. The average man changes the channel using the remote switch every 8 seconds. So that doesn't happen in radio. He thought radio was the great underused medium. And boy, he used it, and he reached people.
He did a commercial, David, that always sticks in my mind, making this point. It was for Robert Abrams running for Attorney General in the state of New York, and it basically showed the face of a absolutely standard industrial clock. And the voiceover, suddenly the picture shows you this clock. The second hand is at 12. And the voice says, would you give me 60 seconds to tell you about why Robert Abrams ought to be Attorney General of New York? Did you know that he did this, that, and the other thing? And your eye is riveted to the clock, but obviously there's no information there. You don't move, and you listen to the whole thing. Tony's strategy, it seemed to me, was very simply blindfold the eye, open up the ear. That carries the heavy freight of what we're talking about. And then it's over, maybe with a little picture of Bob Abrams and his wife and his dog or something at the end, but an entirely he's using television to be radio.
Chris, the view of reaching people with a simple image, feeling that the eye distracts and the ear is what we are really about as human beings, because it goes straight to the brain. Think of Whoops. Now, Whoops was the Washington nuclear power facility, and
yes.
Whoops was a huge amount of money put into nuclear power by the nuclear industry. They had to win the state of Washington. And the opponent was Tony and some little group. By the way, any group could come to Tony, and if he agreed with your message, he'd do your radio or television. In this case, he made one radio ad and one television ad. They were the same, except the television had a single still photograph of a power plant, and it was called Whoops because the price of the nuclear power was going up in the state of Washington.
You know, when Whoops announced they were going to build new power plants, they said they would cost $4 billion. And then, whoops, they went up to $8 billion. Whoops to $14 billion. Whoops to $20 billion. And now, whoops, $24 billion. The Whoops contractors say you should vote no on Initiative 394. We're the Don't Bankrupt Washington Committee, and we say let's just vote yes on Initiative 394 to let the voters decide if a new power plant should be built. Sorry about that, Whoops.
When the state of Washington's listeners and viewers saw that, that was the end. The opponent had spent upwards of $40 or $50 million, I think, making that advertising campaign that they made. And Tony did one spot, and he destroyed the credibility. And why? Because people knew that the price had gone up. He used the truth to remind people of things they already knew, and he believed in something I find really interesting, shame.
Hmm. Speak about shame. How did he use shame?
Tony used shame in the way that the Chinese use it when somebody commits a crime. You know, they take his picture and they put it on the walls on the bus and train stations, and everyone sees it, and the person is near death as a result. Well, that isn't just the Chinese, Tony found out. Shame and shaming public figures. Tony found this particularly intriguing and also particularly easy. I can think of one particular case where the Connecticut River, some people felt, was being polluted by General Electric that had a plant upriver. And someone came to Tony, and Tony agreed, and he did a spot that said, basically, this Saturday morning, would you like to get back at General Electric for polluting the Connecticut River? Well, I'm going to tell you how. Go to, and then he gave the address of the chairman of General Electric, who lived in Fairfield, Connecticut, and said, let's be there at 9 a.m., and let's dump garbage on his front lawn, because he's dumping pollutants on ours.
Mm.
That was the spot. Well, he was about to run it, but he did something that you know he does, Chris, which is he never ran that spot. He sent it to General Electric in an audio tape. The chairman's PR guy played it, horrified, calls Tony and says, don't run that spot. Don't run that publicly. We will do something about this issue immediately. Mm. And Tony learned something by that, which he used the rest of his life. He didn't even have to buy time on the radio. He could just send you what he was about to play. And if you knew that the public agreed that shame was a factor, you very often did something about it without even playing the spot on the air.
Could we talk, David, about his theory of the so-called responsive chord? It was at the foundation of a lot of this thinking that a politician is not giving people critical information. He's trying to ring their bells of their own biases, hopes, prejudices, past patterns, party affiliation, etc., to bring up the chord that will sound with the note he's striking.
I believe that Tony Schwartz's philosophies and views and what he learned really help anyone to communicate, even husband and wife, even parent and child. Essential to Tony Schwartz was the responsive chord, and he wrote a book called The Responsive Chord. And he said, communication is not what I say, it's what you hear.
Hmm.
It's not the words that I use, it's how you interpret those words. And in order for me to communicate with you, I have to know how you feel and think. If you feel that war is wrong, I cannot sell you on a war by just talking about the war. I've got to start off with the position that you think war is wrong. I have to convince you that war may not always be wrong before I can talk to you at all. That's what he called the responsive chord.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he said, basically said, it's not what I say to you. Therefore, Mr. Corporate Guy, Mr. Political Guy, don't tell me what you think. Speak to me about what concerns me.
Yes. This is what he said. He said to me one time that politicians have got to get away from the public address and into the private undress. In other words, take the mystique, take the authority, take that strident Jimmy Carter tone that we heard a moment ago, be rid of it. This to me had very, very interesting implications about my work and even about politics in general. When you realize that the audience is very smart, they're not just waiting for the guy who's come a million miles to tell them something they didn't know. They're very smart. They're very experienced. They can judge candidates and newscasters for that matter. What they want to know is where you connect with them and where you want to take the conversation slowly with respect. But it seems to me what applies to individual listeners also applies to the mass. Nobody's talking in this country to, including the media and the candidates, nobody's talking to sort of uninformed people that just woke up with a blank slate. You're talking to a huge, diverse organism of thinking, culture, habit, phrases, understanding, misunderstanding, and it's got to be brought along very, very respectfully. I mean, the day of which in which Walter Cronkite could say, that's the way it is, I'm Walter Cronkite, you're not, go back to sleep, has given way, I think, to the Tony understanding of, no, many, many responsive chords out there, and the art and the trick is to just add the note that supplements and changes it in the right direction.
Well, let me just say that I don't really agree with you that things have changed. I'm not speaking politically now, but George Bush and his allies had the opinion that you could basically manipulate the American public.
They did.
To feel the way you do. And that goes on in advertising all the time. Just last night on television, I saw an ad that I believe nobody believes about a furniture store. I also think that you, Chris, the reason that I'm on this radio program, and also I think a lot of people listen to you, is because you seem to speak for me. Your acerbic, intellectual, provocative questions and answers follow the way I want to be if I were talking to Tony Schwartz or David Hoffman. So you're doing it in a way. And I just was thinking of Tony. In Tony's view, that to provoke is a good thing. He was for provoking people. And he did a radio spot when the chairman of the board of Philip Morris was appointed the chairman of the board of Lincoln Center in New York City. And he produced a radio spot, ran it once, that said, Lincoln Center, the great center for culture and art, where human beings are cherished, has a man at its head who is killing 390,000 people a year. Mm. Now, most people wouldn't say that. My God, saying on the radio, the guy's killing 390,000 people? I said that to Tony. Tony, you can't say that. That's horrible. Tony said, yes, I can. And he did. And the man was removed. It horrified the city. Mm. So Tony went after those words and phrases that that were just at the bottom line of what was happening.
Who is practicing Tonyisms in 2008, David? Who is thinking Tony's way about the Obama-McCain campaign?
I think that in the Obama-McCain campaign that we're watching right now, it's extraordinary, and it is the result of Tony Schwartz. Both of these men are more honest in their reactions than, God, if you think about the Kennedy-Nixon era, Kennedy came out and he was real, Nixon came out and he performed, and it was devastating for Nixon on television. Today, you're really getting a sense from these two men of how they feel, their values, what they think is important, what insults them, what they won't talk about and what they will. It's the most real campaign, unmanipulated, between two what seem to be fairly decent American men that I've ever seen. And I'm feeling that I'm getting a sense of these two guys that by the time I have to go into that voting booth and do my electronic voting, I'm going to know what I feel. I have never seen anything like it, really. And their reaction to each other, what's a personal insult, what they choose to say, there seems to be, there's certainly a political handling of each guy that he tries to say what he thinks as best as he can. But if you're using the honesty meter, both of these guys seem honest on television to me. How do you feel?
I think we're getting there, but I think both of those candidates may be stuck in the public address mode as opposed to the private undress. We'll see. I hope he gets either one of them or somebody like them in effect on the couch. Really, what do you care about in the middle of the night? What are you deeply worried about? You know, I think Tony would say to Obama, get on the radio. Let people hear that voice. He ran a very successful campaign for Andrew Young, running for mayor of Atlanta, or Congress from Atlanta originally, in which he introduced Andrew Young and his values and his voice before he introduced him in pictures. That was a very different time in terms of racial attitudes in this country, but it seems to me also that just the value of that eloquent man, and his writing is his own, is made for radio. I have two other instructional questions, though, for you, David. One, what would Tony be doing in an age of internet advertising, in which commercial radio, where he plied his trade, is shrinking?
A fantastic question, and I have to think about it myself. First of all, Tony looked at the medium. He said that television was a medium where you sat back in your chair. Sitting back, he felt, was very important for television. That anyone who made something that made you sit up in your chair, it wasn't going to work on TV. TV was about the experience of television. He said, during radio, you're mostly doing something like driving, and that your mind is totally free. You're not using your mind. It's kind of like we now are passing these cell phone laws. Well, he saw the radio as you could really get involved with radio. So he looked at the medium. He looked at the internet, and I look at the internet, and he said, you know, this isn't a very emotional medium. Sound is emotional. If there's no sound and you're showing some pictures, forget it. You might as well just put the words out there and give information. I'm amazed that when you click video on AOL or any other place, you see this ad that had formerly run on TV, or it was TV-like. That's just plain irritating. People don't watch ads on the internet.
I think that's so subtle. He would be saying, because I say it, that the voice, the human voice that integrates so much kind of chaos into a palpable human stream is the answer to information overload.
It does.
But you got to get the audio up on people's computers. Can I ask you the second part of the internet question, which is the internet and all of the tools for using it, for making videos, for posting a YouTube, etc., have become so inexpensive. Everybody's doing it. If Tony could open a school for everybody who's practicing media now for the first time, what would he be telling people?
The first thing he would say is you don't need to worry about fancy technologies. The microphone needs to be fairly close, and the person needs to talk directly to the camera, not acting like they're doing an interview. Second, he would say that the face expresses emotion, and maybe the hands, but it's always a tight shot or a medium tight shot. So silly wide shots on the computer screen don't work. The third thing he would say is that going decently slow. There was this concept that kids want things faster. If you watch the Disney Channel, it's unbelievable that the editing is less than a second per shot in many cases, like movie trailers. Tony felt that was absolutely not true, and he had some good research from the ad agency Ogilvy & Mather that showed that, in fact, young people don't see things and hear things any faster than old people. We want to be talked with. We want a chance to contemplate. That is not being done on the internet, and he would teach that.
What would he tell people about their voices and how to project them or not project them? What would he tell people about the body language of their own voices?
Tony said, you really can't change your speech. I am sounding right now like a New Yorker, like I'm not that young, both of which are true. A little bit of an accent, a little bit of a fast speech. I know this about myself. I can't change it. I wish I could. I would like to sound like one of Tony Schwartz's narrators, some of the best voices there are in America.
Bob Landers,
wonderful voice, but I can't. So I really have two choices. One is to get to a Bob Landers and have him speak my words, and certainly political people and advertising people do this all the time. The other is for me to accept my voice and try my best to communicate it. So Tony would say, I know, he would speak like this. He would say, I know I sound a little bit slow speaking, but give me a moment to speak with you anyway. That's how Tony would speak. He would start off by telling you he's aware of his frailties, his humanity. He got everyone that way. You know, Tony had a familial handshake. I don't really know what that was, but whenever he intended to do something like shake your hand, his hands shook. And he would start off a conversation with you when he met you by saying, I'm sorry, my handshake, I have a familial handshake disease. And boy, you were on his side. You were rooting for him. He was a human being. Be yourself. You'll communicate your values and ideas. He believed in honesty. He really did. He believed in verbally expressing your weaknesses, your concerns, your questions, your uncertainty. He truly believed that the answer to many questions was, I think I feel this way, or this is how I feel, but I don't know if it's correct. It's how I feel. And he also believed that if someone else felt similarly, you and they could communicate. So even though you didn't have anything in common with a person, they were a different political party, They were a different age. They were a different race. They were a different gender. If you could find a connection, you could communicate. And I should tell your audience that Tony didn't just work for Democrats. He had dozens of Republicans who he also agreed with, who said his point of view towards life and times and things, and he did their political campaigns as well.
David, there's a commercial here for a guy named Bill Clinton running for governor of Arkansas more than 30 years ago. Tony Schwartz did it, and he had a lot of talent to work with here, but I also suspect that he did a great deal of coaching with this young candidate, telling him, be yourself, go with your strength. And I'll bet this wonderful commercial was in fact the 11th or maybe the 37th draft. Let's listen to Bill Clinton for governor in the mid-70s.
I'm Bill Clinton. I walked into a service station about 7 weeks ago, and this old man was in the service station, and when I walked in, he kind of puffed up like a peacock real proud, and he said, well, son, I cost you 11 votes. How many people you think hurt you that bad? I laughed. I said, well, not many. He said, well, I did. He said, it was me and my two boys and their wives and six of my friends. We just leveled you. And I said, why'd you do it? And he said, well, you raised my car license, and I didn't want to pay it. And I said, well, don't you think the roads needed it? And he said, yeah, but I still didn't want to pay it. And I asked if he liked Governor White, and he said, oh, Lord, no, he's worse. And then I asked him if he would ever consider voting for me in the future. And he looked down at his shoes, and then he looked back up to me and nodded his head, and he said, well, yeah, we're even now. I know that I made a mistake, and I'd like for you to treat me like the prodigal son now and take me home, because we've got a lot more important problems to worry about, like the utility problem and jobs coming into our state and what the whole future is.
Paid for by the Clinton for Governor Committee.
No music, talking to one person, pretty effective.
Just wonderful. There was no way to beat that candidate, and Tony knew it. And that isn't just Bill Clinton. That's anybody who's themselves. I mean, that is really classic. That's classic Tony Schwartz. He recorded that in his studio, and Clinton had the wisdom to know that he couldn't beat this other guy by the facts and the figures and the, you know, we care about humanity. We care about the working man. He had to tell a story, and he did, and that radio spot was unbeatable.
Tony did many funny things. I know you think this is a little down market, but this was just for his friends. It was a commercial he made or pretended to make in 1974 at the height of the Watergate turmoil when the Nixon ship was sinking, but he finally went on the radio to talk about it.
Good evening. I want to talk to you tonight from my heart on a subject come to be known as the Watergate Affair. How could it have happened? Who is to blame? It's the real thing. The easiest course would be for me to blame those to whom I delegated the responsibility. But that would be a cowardly thing to do. I will not place the blame on subordinates. In any organization, the man at the top must bear the responsibility. That responsibility, therefore, belongs here, in this office. I accept it. There can be no whitewash at the White House. God bless America. How could it have happened?
Give Nixon credit. He took responsibility.
Tony Schwartz saw Richard Nixon as an unbelievably large target. He said, David, I cannot believe how funny, silly, pompous this guy is. He really was such a large target that Tony just couldn't resist the opportunity to stick it to him, and that's still funny today.
I had that tape for years in my pocket. And love to play it on the radio and otherwise. There are two other Tony masterpieces that I think we have to get in here. One is the fire prevention commercial, which speaks for itself about a lot of things. Tony's passion, but Tony's craft, Tony's technique, Tony's love of voice. And then the coup de grace it comes after that. But this was his close the door commercial, in effect for the fire department in New York.
A fire breaks out on the first floor of a two-family house.
Door.
The woman quickly leaves to call the fire department.
Door.
And two people die upstairs, overcome by smoke.
Door.
A man smoking in bed starts a fire. The door. Leaves the bedroom, rushes to a phone. The door. And before the fire department gets there, the door. The rest of his house burns down. The door. Is there one single act that could have been done? Close the door. To help prevent this needless loss of life and property. Close the door. What should these people have done? Close the door. Do you know that a door is one of the best pieces of firefighting and life-saving equipment? Close the door. And if you leave a room that is on fire, close the door. If you simply close the door, close the door. It will help stop the fire and smoke from spreading too quickly. Close the door. This life-saving information is brought to you by this station and the New York City Fire Department. Close the door, please.
You know, hundreds of fire departments around the country use that, and I used to ask people, when you have heard that spot once, do you ever forget it? And no one says they do. And 4 months ago, I had a fire that burned my house and my studio down.
Oh, my word.
Yes, I did. And my wife, I wasn't there, as she opened the door to my studio, saw flames in my studio, all my films burning, all my audio tapes burning, including my Tony Schwartz, she closed the door. And that protected my house, and my studio burned, but most of my house didn't. That is Tony Schwartz doing the public a service. He got the local fire department to back it because he heard a story where the door wasn't closed in New York City and decided this had to be done.
He did something for everybody with an extraordinary private piece about his own niece named Nancy. And I think he explains exactly what it's up to. But this is an album, an unforgettable album of 13 years of life delivered in less than 2.5 minutes. Let's listen.
Good morning. Every year for the last 13 years, I've been presenting the story and sound of the growth of my niece. Well, this year, I'm going to present it in an unusual manner. We've all heard of time-lapse photography. That is the type of photography where one can see within a few minutes the full process of growth of a flower, of an animal, of a home, of a building, and so forth. Well, I'm going to apply this technique to the growth of my niece, Nancy, in sound. And here, in 2 minutes and 13 seconds, without any interruption, you will hear Nancy's voice from the age of about 1 month all the way up to 13 years of age. That's 13 years condensed into 2 minutes and 13 seconds. Here goes.
Jack and Jill went up the
hill
to fetch a pail of
water.
Jack fell down and broke
down.
And Jill came tumbling
after. Happy birthday, Daddy. Happy birthday. Happy birthday to you. If you call the toy store up and you say, I want a puppy and a whistle and a horn and a hat and a dress and a ballerina costume, that's what you get. But when Santa Claus can't bring you, you can't cry. Tony, if the dog makes Willie a house, if you have to make him a house broken, if he makes Willie in the apartment, you have to slap him with a newspaper. Then if he doesn't do it again, he's housebroken.
What do you think of the Russians sending the dog up in the satellite?
Well, I hope he doesn't get hurt. But if he does, I'm sure they'll send up a medical satellite.
In school, we each had to do a report on someplace. And I'm doing a report on Hawaii. And we're taking notes and doing research.
This summer we're going camping, and in the month of July, this summer I'm going. For the whole month of July, this summer I'm going to go to Brownie Sleepaway Camp. It's all girls.
You'll mess my hair, and it's very special for tonight. It's just the way I want it. It's in a page boy with a high top, and that's the way I like it.
I'm taking guitar lessons, and that's fun. I take drama lessons after school, and that's great. And I've been working on the school newspaper. I might be editor next year. And I've been discovering boys.
12 years in 2 minutes and 4 seconds. This is Tony Schwartz saying, see you next week.
David, we could do this forever.
Well, let me just say about what you just heard, that Tony believed that children and infants had the mind to think, but not the technical ability. So he was very interested in young people. It's really a great way to look at children, that they're ready to speak, that they have ideas. They just can't say them yet. So he took those baby ideas and felt that they were communicating something. The second thing is, as you remember, Chris, Tony always had a tape recorder on him. He recorded everything. He believed that the sound of speech was the body language of the ear. That was a phrase of his. And he was a guy who recorded everything, who believed in the value of sound. And still today, I ask myself, with that piece you just played, would a picture help? Well, maybe one, just to see what she looks like. But beyond that, the power of the message is in that sound.
Absolutely. I discovered it years later in doing talk radio. The incredible range and power and beauty and fascination of people's accents, people's excitement, people's emotion, people's fear, people's hesitation, people's aggressiveness. Calling into a radio show gave it a kind of substance that I'd never heard in media before. And it changed my thinking profoundly. And I'm only one of many people, I would say, of the Jay Allison or Ira Glass school, and lots of guys and women younger than me, like my producer Paul McCarthy, who have learned everything from Tony. I wonder, but we'll find out, where they want to go with this medium. And the power, I always think it's part of the evolutionary story. The messages that the ear had to distinguish and learn about, warnings, assurances, who was trustworthy, what were they getting in other people's voices, these were crucial evolutionary choices long before there was anything like pictures or even the written word. So I guess my puzzle is, where do we go with all this wisdom? Where does it go from here?
I think that the internet, I think everybody agrees that the internet is the way to communicate. I think that sound on the internet has not been dealt with yet. Most people turn their sound off. They're just not using it, Chris.
I think you're giving us the cue we want, David, is to learn from Tony and apply it with sound on the internet.
Our hope, and I know when you called me to ask me to be with you on this program, it was your hope, is that we can provoke people today to use these basic Tony Schwartz ideas, because they are even more relevant today with the enormous opportunity of the internet, the simplicity of technology, both video and audio, with just an awareness of being honest and real and with your foibles. You can do better than you've ever done before in using the internet, in communicating with wife, husband, children, and colleagues. And I know that's what you asked me to do, and I hope that people got that from this radio show.
You said it exactly as I couldn't have. But think of all those people out there with something to say, too. This is could be a moment of great liberation. It sure is a joy to remember that wonderful Tony Schwartz.
Well, Tony Schwartz died a week and a half ago, and I'm appreciative of the chance to be with you and to remember really a great man who gave a great deal to you and I and to hundreds of other professionals, and to hope that millions get something from what he had to give after his death.
I realize anew, David, he's still teaching me. Those lessons are deep buried in what I do and what I want to do, so let's keep doing it. David Hoffman, it's been such a pleasure, and it's a joy to hear you on Open Source.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate it.
We'll do it again. Paul McCarthy produced and edited this program for Open Source at the Watson Institute at Brown University. Please join the post-game show with your own comment on our website at www.radioopensource.org. And send your own thoughts and your own brainstorm for the next programs by email to chris@radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon, and I approve this podcast. Thank you for being there.